Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Jack Gantos has the rare gift to entertain and get boys reading his over 40 books for children and teens. Yet at the same time, he gives those young readers insights into their own lives, stories about the larger world encompassing history and geography, and a way to understand themselves and their circle of peers, relations, and other grown-ups better. For that, Gantos will receive the Tulsa Library Trust's Ann V. Zero Award for Young Readers Literature this Friday evening at the Hardesty Regional Library. Gantos won the 2011 Newbery Medal for Dead Inn in Norvelt, an autobiographically based novel of growing up in Norvelt, Pennsylvania, a utopian Depression-era community founded by Eleanor Roosevelt. His follow-up, From Norvelt to Nowhere, follows up with the characters as well. Gantos' overall work include 10 picture reader books featuring Rotten Ralph, an almost utterly unredeeming cat, 5 novels featuring Joey Pigza, a boy with attention deficit disorder, and 5 autobiographical Jack Henry novels. Gantos' work has been framed by his copious journaling, which he's done since he was elementary age, and his own unusual life, which features numerous moves after leaving Norvelt, a more than average number of boyhood mishaps, as well as a brush with the law. That authenticity of voice has endeared him to several generations of boy readers who laugh and learn at the same time. Again, Jack Gantos will receive the Tulsa Library Trust Ann V. Zero Award for Young Readers Literature this Friday evening at the Hardesty Regional Library, and he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Jack Gantos, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Rich. It's a pleasure to be here.
And congratulations on the Zero Award. It's richly deserved.
Well, thank you. It was a great surprise. And like many awards, when they are surprises, it just seems to double the pleasure.
One of the things that in reading your books, there seems to be a twofold mission. One is these wonderful, wacky stories that are a big part of a lot of your books. And at the same time, there seems to be a little subversive message about getting boys to read. Was that conscious, or is it just a matter of how you tell your stories?
Well, I would say, to cover all my bases, of course, it's both. But in truth, it is both. In one sense, of course, I advocate reading. But on the other sense, when I write a book, I want the character to have some sort of interior life, an articulate interior life. And if you have a character who reads books, then they begin to reflect on what they're reading. And what they're reading reflects, of course, on the world around them. And so they become characters with an inner dialogue, boys with a real inner dialogue, rather than just a stimulus-response kind of character. You have a thinking character and a character that has an emotional range, which I think is really healthy for boys.
There's a story that you wrote for a compilation called Guys Read Funny Business. And it sort of sums up how you approach this writing approach that will appeal to boys. It's a very funny story about a boy who's hanging out with the wrong crowd, always getting into trouble. And they're basically a couple of guys that I think we'd call them knuckleheads in our day. They were a couple of knuckleheads who were always figuring out ways to screw up. And the character's hanging out with them, and he has this wart on the bottom of his foot. He pulls it out with a pair of rusty pliers. It gets infected. He doesn't tell his mother. And that's sort of the genesis of a lot of these stories. These are the stories boys have that they don't tell their mother.
Well, yes, because boys have a very keen preconceived notion about what is acceptable behavior and what is not acceptable behavior, in particular with your mother. And when I pulled that wart out, I did pull a wart out of the bottom of my foot with a pair of rusty needle-nose pliers, and it did. It got really infected, and it swelled up really to the size of, you know, like a Hormel 2.5-pound canned ham. I couldn't even get a sneaker on, and I was sort of dragging it around like Igor. And finally, you know, the first time my mother took me to the hospital, I played like it, nothing ever happened. I had no idea. And then finally, it just looked so serious. So we went back to the hospital, and I had to confess in front of the doctor and my mother. And my mother just looked at the doctor and said, "This is my son. He's an idiot." The doctor said, "You know what you did?" And I was like, "No, I'm obviously too stupid to know what I did, you know." Ever hear of blood poisoning?
Yeah. And this is the other part of your writing, that a lot of the writing comes from your actual life. You've been an inveterate journal keeper from a very early age.
Yes.
And you keep them today. You have them today. What is it, a couple hundred volumes? Maybe more.
I do. In fact, I just got back from the gym, and I get on the rowing machine for a half an hour, and then I row like a lunatic for a half an hour and get myself all steamed up, and then I have my journal right there. And while I'm on the machine, like, things are just popping into my brain, and then I hop off, and then, you know, I just write like crazy while sitting, you know, in the locker room. And then I come home, and then I eventually go to the library. But I always have some sort of journal, some sort of device with me to write on. And, in fact, I've been doing it since elementary school. I write all my books out by hand, usually with fountain pens. And then after that, then I type them up. And then after that, you know, they go into the computer, and then, you know, you do your 100 drafts, and it gets polished up.
How did you get started journaling? I understand your mother didn't think you should be journaling at the very beginning.
No, it was a confusing gender operation for my mother. When gifts were handed out, my older sister got a journal. I'm not sure what I got, but it would probably be, you know, according to my mother, it would probably be like a slingshot or a nuclear device. And so my sister got the journal, and I said to my mom, I want one too. And she said, no, girls get journals, and I don't know what boys get, you know. So I was like, no, I really want one. And so I just pitched a fit until I got one. And honestly, the only reason I wanted it was because of the lock and key that was on the outside of it. Because it meant something that was private. And you know, when you're a kid, privacy is at a premium. Especially when, you know, you live in a small house where there are more people than rooms, and every room you go to, there's a person. Yeah. So inside that little book was the inside of my own private hideaway room. I could lock the door on the book, and that appealed to me greatly.
Now, as I understand it, it was not an easy decision for your mother to let you have a diary or a journal. In fact, you kind of committed an unforgivable act, didn't you, in the course of getting that diary?
Well, that was shameful, absolutely shameful. So it may have been the same pair of pliers that I used on my foot that I used on my sister's lock. And I snapped the lock on her journal, and I read it. And I have to say, the most amazing thing to me was that it was a little bit vacuous. I mean, my sister was like clearly the smartest person in the family, head and shoulders above everybody. But when it came to sort of spotting and writing about really unusual, keen, weird, wild, wacky things, that was not my sister. My sister was like, it's a beautiful day, I'm very happy, life is good, my friends are fine. And I'm like, I ripped a word out with a pair of pliers. You know, I saw my dog eaten by an alligator, and, you know, on and on and on. And so when I saw her writing, all I said to myself is, I just have to do the opposite of this, and it'll be perfect.
Now, didn't that story appear in a book later, the opening up the sister's diary?
Yes, it did. And my sister was, not only was she smarter, she was also bigger and tougher and meaner. And so I suffered for it. And you know, I mean, and of course, the pangs of guilt have, you know, crippled me all my life, but it did get me launched.
And those journals today, I assume they're an important part of when you're trying to get back to fourth grade or fifth grade or seventh grade. Those journals help you remember.
Yes. I think one of the great things about writing something down, even if you just open a journal and write aimlessly for 5-10 minutes a day, one phrase, one sentence, one description, one little snippet of dialogue can take you all the way back down a rabbit hole to when you were in third grade and said it, or fifth grade and said it. And so even though as the writer or the journal keeper, you're thinking, oh, I'm really not making significant prose right here, significant literature in this journal. What you are doing is you're leaving the breadcrumbs, the Hansel and Gretel breadcrumbs, to find your way all the way back home to those really significant moments. And that's key.
And have you found that as you're looking through these journals, you see a crumb of an episode that's written down, but then all of a sudden the memories come flooding back and you go, oh my gosh, you're reliving that moment.
Exactly. You're nearly paralyzed because it just completely takes you over. And it takes you over with pleasure too. Well, if it's a pleasurable memory.
Now, one of the things seems to be coming out is how autobiographical a lot of your writing is. How much autobiography is there in, say, your Jack Henry books, your Joey Pigza books, Rotten Ralph, I know it even has a basis in fact, even though it's about a cat.
Well, yes, it was an inspirational cat. Nicole Rubel and I, she's the illustrator and co-creator of Rotten Ralph, we were working on books together, and I was kind of writing really soft, fuzzy, lovely, charming, wonderful books, and we couldn't get published. And so I thought, oh, I should go get a cat. I love cats, and I'll write about a cat. So I got a cat. We went over and got a cat from Harvard University, and the cat turned out to be just a wicked, wicked cat. And so I thought, oh, I'll write about this cat. And so I wrote Rotten Ralph, and that book got published. And so I thought, well, write about the stuff you love. So... from there, then I went into my journals, and I started pulling out all the things from my journals. So all the Jack Henry books, all five volumes of the Jack Henry books are based on something that took place first in my journals.
Now, I have to ask you about Jack Henry's Jack's Black Book. Now, okay. Was this a real? There's a story I hear is that you actually took one of your journals, sort of gussied it up, gave it a library card when you were working in a library, and you waited for somebody to check it out.
Yes, I did. I did. Just to back it up for a second, I went to 10 schools in 12 grades. So, like, I was always hanging out in the library because, one, it was the safest place. Two, librarians love people that read. And three, I love librarians. So, you know, it was like a perfect location for me. So I would always go over to the shelf and look at where my book would fit, you know, in the PZ section. Where would the Gantos go? You know, between Galdone and George. So then I thought, well, I'll make my own dang book, and I'll put it there. And I got a library pocket and glued it in the back and put a card in it and put a PZ number on it. And I waited, and I waited and waited. I waited about 3 weeks. Poof, gone. I was like, whoa. And then I waited, like, forever. And then it came back. And then they wrote a little note in there. The note said, the writer of this book should seek help. And I never found out who checked that book out, but the fact that they were so funny with that line, that comment, I knew that they had to be somebody I wanted to know, and I never did know them, never met them.
I would think you would use that as a blurb.
I know. That's a great blurb in my world.
My guest today is Jack Gantos, the writer of books for children, teens, and adults. He's written over 40 books. He'll receive the Tulsa Library Trust and V-Zero Award for Young Readers Literature this Friday evening at 7 o'clock at the Hardesty Regional Library. He's the creator of the stories of Jack Henry, very autobiographical, Rotten Ralph, about the worst cat in the world who has this is a young reader for the most part. A Rotten Ralph is a horrible cat that just has, it's a sociopathic cat, I think, is the best way to do it. Joey Pigza, a very interesting character. And then some of his more recent books have had a character named Jack Gantos. And I'd like to ask you about this. Dead End in Norvelt, which won the Newbery Award, and From Norvelt to Nowhere. First of all, the main character is Jack Gantos. And this is a story of your pretty early years. I mean, you're using your own name, right?
Yes. Well, I'm from Norvelt, Pennsylvania.
Tell us a little bit about Norvelt. Norvelt is a very unusual little town.
It is. And I would suspect you might even have some Norvelt-type towns out in Oklahoma. During the Depression years, when Roosevelt became president, you know, things were pretty grim in America. You know, 25 to 40% of the people out of work. And we're from western Pennsylvania. It was coal mining and farming and factory work. And so what happened is Eleanor Roosevelt, who had really a heart of gold, she looked out at the country and said, well, you know, people need proper housing. So they started in developing these little housing communities. And so they bought a big farm, the old Hearst farm. It was about, so 300 acres, say. And then the government designed houses, these cute little Cape Cod houses, and they did 250 houses, and they had a community farm, a community factory, a community chicken hatchery, and people moved in with their families, and everybody had community work and worked, and they made a living for themselves. And one of the principles was a very Jeffersonian principle, and that is that a family should have a house on enough property where they could have land to grow crops in times of a depression so they could always feed their family. So these towns were put together by the federal government and by Quakers and by many organizations that were, you know, big-hearted. So at any rate, my grandfather was a coal miner, and they got one. So that's where my mom grew up and I grew up.
And this is a wonderful story, Dead End and Norvelt, and with some wonderful characters. The mother and father are interesting characters. The boy is a very interesting character. And what I love about this is it's a funny story. Boys will love it. And yet you're so subversive. You're telling all sorts of history through a neighbor named Miss Volker, who's an old lady who's written for the newspaper. Now she has arthritis and she can't write, so Jack goes over to write her obituaries, which always include a very leftist social agenda in the course of it. Whether it's George Custer, who was wiped out and trying to exterminate the Indians, there's always a message in her writing, and it's just so much fun to read.
Well, Miss Volker, who is based on a real character, was hired by Eleanor Roosevelt to be the nurse of that town. And she nursed everything, horses, all cattle, all people, treated with the same tools. And one of the things is she wrote all the obituaries and then had a This Day in History section. So she would always match up an obituary with a little history message. So I went down to help her type those up because she had arthritis. And so my sense of history was completely different than her sense of history. I was reading that landmark series of histories for boys. And, you know, and basically they would, you know, you would read about, oh, let's say Cortez, and they would, you know, talk about how great Cortez was. And then they would just sort of gloss over the fact that he, you know, like spread smallpox to about 1 million, you know, people in Mexico and killed them, but he was heroic anyway. And it would be like, wait a minute, back that up, you know. And then so I'd go down and I'd say to Ms. Volker, you know, Cortez is really, you know, like a great guy. And she would just go through the roof. Are you kidding me? You know, the people he slaughtered. And then she would come at it from a completely different angle. Now, her angle would be more like my mother's angle. And my father's angle would be more like, well, they got in the way of the smallpox. They should have died, you know, so it was living in a world where you got to see the extremes of personal and political values. And one of the things that I loved about Norvelt was the value of that town was pure helping hand. I mean, it was people helping people, and that's why my mother loved that town. She grew crops, she cooked for the elderly, she knew everybody. If you were sick, she brought you a pie. I mean, those were just her values, and those were the values that she taught me to bring to the world. And when I grew up, and as a young boy, you know, trying to sort out my values, when I grew up and looked out at the world, it was a lot more menacing than my mother's values and what Norvelt was. And it was really hard to sort of parse that as a young man, because I wanted to be a good person, and I looked out into the world, and it was a pretty difficult stage to be as good as you should be.
Yeah. It must have been unusual where, you know, you had these very social jobs. There's a character, Mr. Spiz, who's basically the guy who says, make sure everybody keeping their property up, basically.
Oh, and, yeah.
And you know, it's just these very sort of socially created jobs. It must have been an unusual early childhood for you.
Well, it was.
Especially when you went out once your family began moving.
Yes. That became very problematic for me because Norvelt created the set of values and morals, values, and ethics that were established with within me as a child. And then when you go out into the world, and again, we, you know, moved constantly. My dad was in the military, and then he was in construction work. And you moved, and each time you moved, you saw that the community had a completely different set of values. And you were constantly questioning yourself, constantly sharpening your own values, constantly perhaps criticizing other people's values. And as a child, it was a very busy time mentally and morally.
And I would think you've mentioned several times with the moving around, you know, finding a group of friends was difficult, and you were never going to be a part of the popular cliques because you were only going to be there for a short amount of time. And so you found yourself attracted to the sort of outsiders who had their own little group of friends. And you said you found that to be tremendously rewarding, especially as you look back on it, because these were the interesting kids. These were not the kids that were worried about looking unpopular or looking bad. They were doing really fun things.
They were doing fun things, and I was fortunate when I look back. Maybe not in the moment. Maybe in the moment I wished I had just lived in one place. But when I look back, I was introduced to a range of characters and a range of kids that ended up being very idiosyncratic and having something that they believed in or loved or did. They were painters or musicians or just funny kids or, you know, just wickedly independent in their own ways. And those kids were the kids that I could kind of buddy up with. They would be willing to take on a kind of traveling friend because I was just traveling through. I was like a tumbleweed friend. And they were accepting. And now when I look back on it, I realize they were accepting because I, too, was like them. I had my own interests, and I was bookish, and I carried a journal around. And, you know, I was one of the geeks wanting to be a freak. I wanted to step up to being a freak.
In writing about Norvelt, this has come pretty recently, just the last few years. Why did you wait to this particular point to actually write about these early years if you feel like they're a big part of who you are today?
I'd nibbled on the edge of writing about Norvelt. I'd written some short stories that had taken place there, but I'd never really laid out the entire novel-length book. And I needed several things, I think, to sort of mature into as a writer. First off, I needed to be able to manage the range of all the different types of characters, all the different kinds of layers of values and thoughts. I needed a completely satisfying plot line that was engaging to hold up the enormous amount of history which is delivered in that book. I mean, the book is nearly a textbook of history.
It really is, and it's the brilliant part about it is it's so seamlessly integrated into the plot that you're teaching history without your readers really knowing you're teaching history.
Exactly. And I don't think I was capable of doing that until I did it. You know, early on, I think I would have bungled the measurements in there. You know, I could have put in too much sugar or too much salt. But this time, I got it just right. The pace of the plot with the delivery of the history, with the build-out of these larger-than-life characters, with really good dialogue, you know, and great incidents. And then, you know, you just sort of measure each part correctly. You know, measure twice, cut once, and then that whole book fit together beautifully.
I want to ask about one other character that you've had great success with, Joey Pigza. You know, we've all seen this kid. I understand the sort of inspiration came from a school visit.
Yes. I visit about 40 schools a year. I still go into the schools and work with students and work with teachers. And I like being a teacher. I was a professor in creative writing and literature for many, many years. And so then I just continue doing it in elementary, middle, and high schools. But when I wrote the Joey Pigza books, I was in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and there was this great kid. I mean, just a great kid. And he was sitting at a desk sort of aside, you know, from the block of desks from other kids. He was more up front, and he was kind of in front of me. And he was just spinning around in his seat. And as I was talking, he was just, like, so on top of it. He was, like, finishing my jokes. I would give him a line, and he would deliver the punchline. And And this kid was like a genius child, but he was just like spinning like a top. And finally, he went from having a really great time to suddenly switching over to being very nervous. And he started to try and get his teacher's attention. And finally, he just blurted out, teacher, I forgot to take my meds. And then she just pointed to the door, and he shot out of that chair, ran down the hallway, punching the lockers, of course, all the way to the nurse's office. And when I saw that kid, I just thought, I love that kid. I just really, you know, some part of my heart went down the hallway with him. And then that night, I took out my journal, and I started writing in it about my day. And I always ask myself, what's the most interesting thing I saw today? As a prompt, and that kid was the most interesting thing, and he continued to be the most interesting thing every day going forward. And I thought, I've got to write about this. And so that's where the kernel, you know, the germ of that book came from, was definitely that kid and the love of that kid.
One thing I was really struck by, I read an account where somebody asked you how you managed to write to get boys to read. And I know this is a big question, and you had a very simple answer, and I wish you would share it with us about writing for boys today.
One of the things that I always think of when I'm getting ready to write a book for a boy is to have an enormous sense of humor. I always decorate my stories with humor. There's humor in the dialogue, there's humor in the descriptions, there's even humor in the action. But under that humor, you know, drilling down the foundation under that humor, then you have pathos, then you have action, then you have reflection, then you have history, then you have the interior of the boy itself, and plenty of action. And so whenever I'm getting ready to write for boys, I'm not just thinking, oh, I'll just give them the action line. That'll be good enough. It's never good enough. I think boys are really good readers. And when you give them genuine, juicy, interior lives of characters, that's what they come to me with. I get about 3,000 letters a year from boys saying, how do you know I felt that way? How do you know I see things that way? I read that book too, and I felt that way. And they love having that connection of their interior life connecting to the interior lives of the characters. So it's not just the exterior, it's the interior. And without that interior world of emotions and hopes and dreams and information, the books would not be very good. They would just be hollow.
Do you feel like the people that write to you are boys today, or do you hear from a lot of girls as well?
Oh, I hear from a lot of girls.
Yeah.
The girl letters are so great, you know, because they're like, I love that. You know, like, I wish I had a wart to pull out too. I'm like, I'll send you one. And then, like with the Joey Pigza books, like, you know, boys will write me and say, that's me, you know. And then the girls will write and they'll go, God, I sit next to that kid. But they're so sweet. They're so good. They're so human because, you know, they go, that kid's been bugging me all year, but now I understand why. Now I understand what's going on inside that kid. And they're very forgiving and empathetic. And I love that the books make young people more perceptive, more forgiving, more understanding, and more embracing of the whole world around them.
Jack Gantos, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Rich. This has been a pleasure, and I certainly will enjoy my trip to Tulsa.
Jack Gantos is the author of over 40 books for children, teens, and adults, and author of the 2011 Newbery Medal-winning Dead End in Norvelt. He'll be receiving the Tulsa Library Trust's NV Zara Award for Young Readers Literature Friday evening at 7 at the Hardesty Regional Library. That event is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.